You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. On the 22nd of February, 1979, residents in an apartment building noticed a putrid smell coming from Lelia Formosano de Ayala's apartment. She was a widow in her late 40s who lived alone. Neighbors knocked on the door, but no one answered, so they called the police. When the officers arrived, they recognized the unmistakable smell of death. They couldn't get in through the front door, so made their way inside via her balcony instead. The apartment was quiet, and nothing looked out of place. Lelia's body was seated in a chair, facing the television that was on. On a side table was a cup with some leftover tea and a plate with morsels of fish. In her refrigerator, police officers found a container of Petite Fours, a tea time favorite among the socialite set of the time. Lelia had died 3 days before, and the funeral home's doctor declared that the cause of her death was a heart attack. It was a sad and tragic event, Lelia dying alone in front of her TV and waiting to be discovered for days. Her friends felt terrible. They were still in shock about losing another friend, Nilda Gamba, who had strangely also suffered a heart attack 10 days prior. Like Lelia, Nilda also died in her home, alone. What were the odds? When a third woman from the same circle of friends collapsed on the stairwell of her apartment building, police could no longer ignore the possibility that the three deaths were connected. They uncovered a crime that caused ripples in Buenos Aires' high society and remained one of the country's most talked about cases. This is the story of the poisoner of Montserrat. Bernardina Maria Mercedes Aponte Morano Borja, known as Gigia, was born on the 20th of May, 1930, in Corrientes. Corrientes is a city north of Buenos Aires, on the banks of the Paraná River. Gigia's mother, Candela, was a housewife, and her father, Camilo Borja Aponte, was a lieutenant colonel in Uriburu's army during the 1930 coup d'etat. Gigia had a brother who eventually followed in their father's military footsteps. They grew up in a time of change and power shift, and with her father in the heart of the action, the family was well known. From a young age, it was evident that Gigia loved the finer things in life and valued her family's position in society. When the Borja family relocated to Buenos Aires, she fell in love with the hustle and bustle of the city. She adored the imposing buildings and the European feeling of the city center and the variety that it offered. From a young age, she loved walking along Avenida Corrientes and soaking up everything that was trending at the time. After high school, Gigia went to college and qualified as a teacher, but she had no intention of ever doing a day's work. Instead, she dated one eligible bachelor after the next, typically men from good stock who had fat wallets. Gigia always looked her best. Before she entered a room, one would hear her coming by her bangles clanging. For exercise, she swam, ensuring that her tall figure was always slim and toned. She was charming and charismatic, and when she spoke, people believed every word she said. When Gigia married civil lawyer Antonio Morano, she discarded her maiden name, contrary to Argentinian custom. People speculated that she chose to do this because she did not want to be associated with her brother, a well-known general at the time. Antonio insisted his wife didn't have to work and that he would take care of her. And that is precisely what Gigia wanted to hear. Her dreams had come true. She was going to be a lady of leisure, living in one of the most beautiful cities in the world. However, behind closed doors, the couple did not have a very glamorous life. They lived in a musty two-bedroom apartment with rising damp and old furniture. Gigia's home was in stark contrast to her appearance. She always presented herself well and looked like $1 million. To achieve this, the lawyer's wife lived well above her means, always spending money she didn't have on jewelry and imported clothing. She boasted that at one point, she even owned 110 pairs of shoes. Her husband Antonio was retired, but Gigia did not spend a lot of time with him. The tall, striking fashionista preferred to be out and about, having tea with friends and going to the movies or attending shows at the theater. She was popular with her friends because they could always rely on her. If they needed anything, Gigia was just a phone call away. But she was more than just a good friend, she was quite an industrious lover too. Throughout her marriage, Gigia had multiple extramarital affairs. She later claimed that she was involved with the richest man in Argentina, who bought her two apartments, one on Avenida Independencia and the other on Luis Sáenz Peña. These were located in the heart of Buenos Aires, within walking distance to shops, restaurants, and patisseries. Gigia proudly admitted that she had an affair with a high-ranking police officer, too. She also had alleged dalliances with the well-known trade union leader and a presidential candidate. She eventually said that she slept with more than 200 men in her lifetime. It was clear that Gigia loved power, sex, and money, none of which she found in her husband Antonio Morano. Whether he was unaware of her infidelity or if he chose to turn a blind eye is not clear. Antonio and Gigia had one son together, Martin. He had a nanny that was a mother figure to him, and he never quite felt a connection to his own mother. And because of Gigia's indiscretions between the sheets, many people questioned whether Antonio was even Martin's father. Martin did not have a happy childhood, to say the least. His mother was absent most of the time, and when she was home, she was always hypercritical of him. The narcissistic Gigia repeatedly told her son that he should be more alive. What he lacked in daring, his mother certainly made up for. Martin recalled Gigia taking him along to her clandestine encounters, saying that they were meeting a distant uncle. She would say to him, "Martincino, treat your uncle well so he gives me nice gifts." Martin was also told to keep his mouth shut about his mother's so-called friends. As a little boy, he did not question his mother. As a grown man, looking back, he realized she only took him with her as a cover. She told Antonio she was taking Martin to the park so she had an excuse to leave the house and hook up with whoever her beau was at the time. When Martin graduated from high school, Gigia told Antonio to stay home, as she was concerned about his well-being. She feared that all the emotion of seeing his only son graduate would damage his heart. Meanwhile, it was a ploy so Gigia could take one of her lovers along as her date. Although this kind of behavior was normal to Martin, it broke his heart that she kept his father away from his graduation. By this time, Antonio knew that his marriage was over. The couple divorced, and Gigia was free to do as she pleased. Although Antonio paid a handsome sum in alimony, Gigia could never have enough. She refused to drop her standard of living, but also did not want to find a job. She had to come up with another scheme. The 40-something single socialite needed to reinvent herself. She hinted to her friends that she uncovered a way of investing money and receiving returns far more attractive than any bank offered. Gigia discreetly approached some of her wealthier friends and promised they could get high returns for their investments. Of course, this was all bogus. The silver-tongued Gigia could sell sand in the desert. She had a way of expressing herself that pulled people in and made them believe her. Three of her closest friends withdrew their life savings and entrusted it to Gigia. As a surety, Gigia wrote promissory notes. It was 1979, and Argentina was still under the rule of dictator Jorge Rafael Videla. With the so-called dirty war raging, crime was not uncommon in Buenos Aires. The military junta committed widespread terror to eradicate their political opponents. It is believed that close to 30,000 people died or disappeared at the hands of the junta. People had to watch their backs, and if one were considered sympathetic to the notion of socialism or left-wing Peronism, your life was in danger. So, with all of that going on in the background, no one ever suspected that Gigia Morano, a well-dressed mother from a respectable neighborhood, was swindling wealthy widows and divorcees out of their life savings. 1979 was a tumultuous year, And before February was through, Gija had lost two close friends. Neil de Gamba and Lelia Formasano de Ayala had both suffered heart attacks. With the stress of everything going on in the country, no one was surprised that it all got too much for them. Then, on the 24th of March, Gija's second cousin, a close friend, also died of a heart attack. Carmen Zulema del Giorgio de Venturini, or Mema, felt unwell in her apartment and went out to get help. She lost her balance at the top of a flight of stairs, and neighbors rushed to help as she tumbled all of the way down. A neighbor, who was a doctor, tried to revive her, but couldn't. As they were waiting for the ambulance to arrive, Mema's cousin Gija went into her apartment. She told the doorman, Jose Gonzalez, that she needed access to her cousin's apartment to get her address book and call the family to inform them of the accident. Gija came out after a short while and accompanied her cousin in the ambulance. Sadly, Mema never regained consciousness. She died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, with Gija by her side. Mema's grown daughter, Diana Maria Venturini, lived with her mother in an apartment block on Hipolito Irigoyen Street. Mema's late husband was a well-to-do businessman who left her with a large inheritance. Mema and Diana lived comfortably and did not want for anything. Diana was devastated after losing her mother. She could not understand how her mother could be happy and healthy one day and then dead the next. She never had any heart problems, and yet she died of a heart attack. Diana thought about her mom's last months alive and wondered if there had been any red flags they had missed. Mema's second cousin, Gija Morano, was a regular visitor in their home. Mema always gave Gija plants, and Gija spoiled Mema with pastries. Not that she was a keen baker, but she had a knack for finding the best patisseries in town. If there was anything Gija could do well, it was shopping. When Gija approached Mema about investing her savings, Mema did not have too many reservations. She asked Gija for some facts and then cautiously invested a small amount to begin with. In a matter of weeks, Gija returned the money along with interest accrued. Mema was sold. Gija and her lawyer friend evidently had a good instinct for investment, and she agreed to hand over a check for 20 million pesos. This was a big decision, seeing as Mema always relied on her husband to handle their finances. Gija gave her as many facts and assurances as she could find and left her with a promissory note as collateral for the deposit. Gija was transparent about the next steps as well. She said that she would go to Mar del Plata straight away to give Mema's check to her lawyer friend. Together with this man, she would deposit Mema's check into the investment account and return the entire amount, plus interest, to Mema on the 27th of March. When Gija returned from Mar del Plata, she paid Mema a visit and assured her that everything had gone according to plan and that Mema would have her money back soon. Gija often visited in the following days and weeks, which made Mema relax about her money. Diana noticed, however, that her mom was very protective of the promissory note, the only proof she had that the 20 million pesos entrusted to Gija came from her. But when Diana sorted through her mother's belongings after her untimely death, she could not find the note anywhere. The only other person who knew where Mema kept the note was Diana's aunt, Gija Morano. Diana replayed Gija's actions on the day of her mother's death and realized how bizarre they were. Firstly, Gija had been to see Mema earlier. According to doorman Jose Gonzalez, she arrived with a small package. He assumed it was a box of tea time treats. He never saw her leave, but when Carmen came out of her apartment looking for help, Gija wasn't there anymore. While Mema's doctor neighbor tried to resuscitate her, Gija returned and told Jose she needed access to her cousin's apartment. She wanted to get her address book to call the family and inform them of the accident. The doorman didn't think it was strange in the chaos of the situation and didn't stand in her way. Gija was only inside for a short while before coming back out. With her, she had some papers and a small bottle. As she left, she made a peculiar remark. She said, "Oh my God, this is the third friend of mine dying in a short time." This is quite a chilling statement, seeing as Mema had not yet died. At Mema's funeral, Gigia wailed with sorrow. She made a big scene of crying, but no tears ever came out of her eyes. Diana couldn't help but wonder if the crocodile tears were part of an act. Then again, Gigia was very self-involved and made everything about herself. So it wasn't entirely out of character for her. Diana could not shake the feeling that her aunt was hiding something. She asked the doorman if anyone had been in the apartment on the day Mema died. He told her Gigia went inside to grab Carmen's phone book because she wanted to call the family. It didn't take Diana long to find the phone book untouched. And after speaking with friends and family, she confirmed that Gigia never called anyone. Diana suspected that Gigia went inside that day with the sole purpose of confiscating the promissory note to erase any evidence of her debt to Mema. Convinced that her aunt had caused her mother's demise to avoid paying back her money, Diana alerted police. She told her about the sketchy investment scheme and about the strange circumstances surrounding Mema's death. She also mentioned that Gigia was supposed to repay her mother on the 27th of March, 3 days after she died. To Diana, this was a clear motive for murder. A second autopsy revealed a large amount of cyanide in Mema's system. It was later said she had enough cyanide in her system to kill an elephant. A small amount would kill an adult in less than an hour. Mema's sudden death was not due to a heart attack. She was poisoned. Investigators suspected that Gigia had cyanide in the small bottle the doorman saw her holding when she left Mema's apartment that day. She had tea and cakes with her cousin one last time, giving her a golden opportunity to slip the poison into something. Police grew concerned when they learned about the other two sudden deaths in Gigia Morano's circle of friends. With evidence gathered regarding Mema's death, investigators convinced the judge to order the exhumation of both Nilda Gamba's and Lelia Formosano de Ayala's remains. Both tested positive for traces of cyanide. However, the amounts were small and could have also been hydrogen cyanide. This could have occurred because of smoke inhalation, or it could have formed in the natural process of decay. The poison in Mema's body was potassium cyanide, which could be found in substances like rat poison, insecticide, and silver polish. According to an article released by Sam Houston State University, cyanide poison detection in 2012 looks something like this. Due to the relatively short half-life of cyanide, from minutes to hours depending on the matrix, toxicological detection of cyanide to confirm cyanide poisoning may only be feasible within the first few hours following exposure. Cyanide levels in blood samples taken at autopsy the next day have been reported to decrease by approximately 79%. Postmortem formation of cyanide may also occur and complicate the interpretation of cyanide results. In 1979, Nilda and Lelia's remains were exhumed more than a month after they died. Any test for cyanide would have been inconclusive. Still, investigators at the time were not deterred. They knew there was a lot of circumstantial evidence linking the deaths. Nilda Gamba lived alone in apartment number 20, next door to Gigia Morano. On Friday night, the 10th of February, Nilda went over to Gigia's for dinner. They had a lovely evening, and Nilda stayed until 1 a.m. The next morning, the doorman noticed something strange. Nilda had the habit of waiting for the newspaper every morning. As soon as it was delivered, she'd open her door and pick it up. But on that Saturday morning, she didn't. When the newspaper was still laying on her doormat by mid-morning, the doorman grew concerned. He asked Jesus Garcia, another resident in the building, to enter Nilda's apartment with him. They struggled to open the door and called police to come and assist them. When police officers broke down the door, they found Nilda's body lying face down on the living room floor, clutching her stomach with her left hand. Nilda complained of sharp stomach aches and nausea when her doctor visited her the night before. Nilda told the doctor that she had dinner with her neighbor and close friend. She said Gigia brought some delicious petite fours for dessert. The doctor called Gigia, who came over straight away to take care of her ailing friend. Once Nilda had settled down, Gigia went back to her own apartment. Sometime during the night, Nilda fell into a coma and never woke up again. She died in the early morning hours of Sunday, February 11th. Gigia contacted Dr. Drenner, whom Nilda had seen the previous night, and asked if he could provide a death certificate, saying it was a heart attack. The doctor refused, saying that he was not the last person to treat her and that he was not certain of what caused her death. Zsuzsa eventually found another doctor to issue the death certificate at a price, and Zsuzsa happily bribed him. The cause of Nilda's death was stated to be non-traumatic cardiac arrest. No autopsy was ever performed. A month before Nilda's death, neighbors realized that they had not seen her in 3 days. They informed police, who forced their way into Nilda's home and found her unconscious on the floor. Fortunately, they were able to revive her and took her to the hospital. Medical staff concluded that Nilda had experienced a diabetic coma. But when she died under similar circumstances, police wondered if this was a failed poisoning attempt, courtesy of Zsuzsa. Lelia Formosano de Ayala was another close friend of Zsuzsa Morano's. The two ladies took frequent trips to the coastal resort town of Mar del Plata together and were the best of friends. On February 19th, a distressed Zsuzsa went to Lelia's apartment looking for her. The doorman wasn't there, so she found his wife. Zsuzsa told the woman she was desperately looking for Lelia, who went home while they were out on the town, because she wasn't feeling very well. The doorman's wife suggested they checked in on her, but Zsuzsa said that if Lelia was home and simply ignored her buzzing, she didn't want to disturb her any further. If Lelia had a stomach bug, it was important that she rested. The doorman's wife found this encounter rather strange, but then again, this was Zsuzsa Morano. Wherever she went, there was always a fuss and a flutter. The next night, Zsuzsa and a group of friends arrived at Lelia's place to pick her up for a movie, but again, she didn't answer the door. Because Zsuzsa had told their friends about Lelia's stomach bug, no one pushed and assumed she did not feel like seeing anyone. On the 22nd of February, Lelia's neighbors called police to express their concern about Lelia. No one had seen her for 3 days, and there was a foul odor coming from her apartment. Police entered Lelia's place via the balcony and found her deceased in a chair facing the television. On a side table next to her was a teacup and a plate with some food scraps. In her fridge, police officers found petite fours. This time, it was the funeral home's doctor who issued the death certificate. Without conducting a post-mortem examination, the doctor stated that the cause of death was non-traumatic myocardial infarction, that is, a heart attack. Investigators dissected the three separate friendships. What did they have in common besides being 40-something socialites with money to burn and time to spare? It didn't take long to establish that, like Mema, Nilda, and Lelia also gave Zsuzsa Morano their money to invest. And like Mema, both died before Zsuzsa could return their investments with the promised interest. It was a large amount of money, close to $300,000. Like Mema, Nilda, and Lelia let Zsuzsa talk them into investing a small amount of money so she could show them how reliable the scheme was. Zsuzsa used the money from other investors to add fake interest, taking the gamble that her friends would invest with her again. And it paid off. After Nilda, Lelia and Mema received a handsome return. They were all eager to use Zsuzsa's investing services again. Zsuzsa gracefully accepted and assured them that they were making a good decision. After relieving them of their money, Zsuzsa went out of her way to assure her investors their money was in good hands. She put a lot of effort into their friendships. They spent a lot of time together, enjoying afternoon tea or going to the movies. Zsuzsa called often and took a great interest in their lives. Days after Nilda's death, on the 19th of February, Zsuzsa was supposed to reimburse her friend Lelia. On the 22nd of February, Lelia's body was found. Investigators were more certain than ever that Zsuzsa had murdered her neighbor, her friend, and her cousin. Looking at the circumstances of Mema's death, they found it to be a carbon copy of the other two. Mema was expecting to get her money back on the 27th of March. On the 24th, she was feeling extremely unwell. She was nauseous and dizzy. She crawled out of her apartment to call for help. She stood up, but experienced a bout of vertigo and collapsed, falling down the stairs. Her neighbors heard the commotion and rushed to her aid. At that very moment, Zsuzsa Morano arrived. She eagerly asked the neighbors if Mema had said anything before she lost consciousness. Then, Zsuzsa disappeared into Mema's apartment to steal the promissory note and remove evidence of her earlier visit. She was by Mema's side in the ambulance when Mema passed away. Investigators talked to the ambulance workers who responded to the call, and they told a chilling story. Apparently, as soon as they told Jija that Mema was gone and that there was nothing they can do, she wanted to know if they thought there would be an autopsy. It was a peculiar question to ask for someone who had just lost a family member. But how did she poison them? Police found Petite Fours in Lelia's fridge, as well as in Mema's apartment. When Nilda called the doctor, she told him about her dinner with Jija the evening before, and that they had Petite Fours for dessert. Because the cake is moist and cyanide smells like bitter almond, no one would have suspected the delicacies were laced with poison. Investigators believed that Jija had obtained cyanide from one of her lovers, an unnamed doctor. Of course, for a resourceful woman like Jija, getting her hands on cyanide would not have been a problem. Chances are she used rat poison or insecticide. So not only did Jija con her closest friends, but she also took their lives. Her investment scheme was a sham Jija had invented to line her own pockets. And by the time police caught up with her, she did not have the money anymore. She had spent every last penny, paying out fake interest to secure future investments. She also used it to fund her lavish lifestyle, draping herself in expensive clothing and jewelry. Jija Morano was arrested at her home on Mexico Street on the 27th of April, 1979. She was dubbed the Poisoner of Montserrat by the media, after the urban neighborhood where she lived and killed. Jija was always photographed wearing oversized sunglasses, making her appear glamorous. Even later on during studio interviews, she always wore sunglasses. It became her signature. When police took her in, she did not resist arrest, but denied all charges against her. She pleaded, "Please, if I don't know how to cook, how am I going to prepare poison pastries?" When asked about the money her friends invested through her, Jija denied that she had stolen it from them. She insisted that all three of her friends had given her their money. She also believed that they had died from natural causes. Her statements were vague and somewhat philosophical, saying things like, "The only thing left to do is to die from one day to the next, and there is nothing we can do. Just bury them and mourn them." But during the hours of interviews, one statement gave a brief flicker into the mind of Jija Morano. Addressing her interviewer, she let slip, "Darling, you have to understand one thing. Murderers never tell the truth." In 1980, while on remand at Ezeiza prison, the notorious Jija was found unconscious on the floor of her cell. She had suffered an aneurysm, but survived. After receiving treatment, she returned to the prison, awaiting trial. But that day didn't come. After 3 years in prison, her lawyers managed to get her acquitted. The judge ruled that there was not enough physical evidence to charge her with her friend's murders. Jija spent 3 years outside of prison and warmed to her celebrity status. She was often seen around town, sporting her signature oversized sunglasses and charming everyone she met. But her days of freedom were numbered. In July 1985, the court went back on its earlier decision and annulled Jija's acquittal. Her retrial ran at the same time as the trial of the Juntas, one of the most prominent cases in Argentinian history. So no one took much note of Jija's story. This time, she was convicted of three murders, and this time, she was sentenced to life in prison. During this time, Jija told anyone who would listen that hers was a case of miscarriage of justice. She insisted that she was innocent, and as soon as she got a 24-hour pass, she went on national TV and pled her case. Eventually, the notorious prisoner got a lucky break when the controversial two-for-one law worked in her favor. This law determined that no one should be on remand for longer than 2 years. If they were, as was the case with Jija, every extra day they spent in precautionary detention would count for two. This drastically reduced many prison sentences. In Jija's case, the judge took into account the time she spent in prison between 1979 and 1982, while waiting for a trial date. In the end, she only served two-thirds of her entire life sentence. On Jija's release, in November 1995, She sent each of the judges who signed her release form a box of chocolates, thanking them for their leniency. Apparently, no one dared to eat the chocolates, as no one felt inclined to sample the poisoner of Montserrat's culinary treats. When asked why people didn't want to eat her food, Gigi always shrugged it off and insisted she was innocent, saying, "I never forced anyone to eat my pastries." Free in Buenos Aires once more, the ever-glamorous Gigi resumed her celebrity status. And the media cashed in. She was employed to write a column in a fashion magazine, and readers lapped up her advice. She made sure she stayed in the limelight too, always agreeing to talk about her life and the crimes she had been convicted of. In 1998, she appeared on a popular daytime talk show hosted by Mirtha Legrand and dropped a bombshell. She said that she found love again and got married. The next day, the supposed husband sheepishly appeared on the same show, saying that he wanted to annul the marriage. They had only spent one night together, and she threatened him never to reveal the truth of their sham of a marriage. Yet he did, on national TV, claiming when she said her name was Mercedes Borja, which is her actual birth name, he never thought he had agreed to marry Gigi Marano. Many years later, Gigi returned to Mirtha Legrand's table and brought some baked treats. She taunted the host, insisting she tried one. Towards the end of the show, Mirtha braved a bite, while the nation held their breath. Fortunately for her, nothing happened. The scene delighted Gigi, who laughed at her own expense. People on the street approached her and asked her for her autograph. She always enjoyed joking with them, offering cakes or sweets, suggesting it was laced with poison. She was amicably known as the well-kempt grandmother with a dark past and a wicked sense of humor. There has even been a critically acclaimed theater production called Gigi the Musical, a comedic look at the circumstances of Gigi's heartless murders. She married her third and last husband, retired journalist Julio Bonin, in 2001. The couple met on a bus tour, and Gigi made sure he didn't forget her. Julio was blind and on one occasion said he only married her because he needed someone to buy his medicine. Even though she claimed the marriage was a happy one, Julio's children said that he threw her out a couple of times. But Gigi always found her way back. The family was less than charmed with her, and she caused a lot of trouble. Once, she bribed a taxi driver 100 pesos to call Julio's daughter to tell her that her boyfriend was cheating on her. This wasn't true, and even though the taxi driver confessed, Gigi denied that she was behind it. On another occasion, Gigi stole a family heirloom, a priceless golden headpiece from Julio's collection of valuables. Julio was furious and didn't believe her when she tried to blame the concierge. During this time, Gigi began cooking for Julio and his family. This was unusual, seeing as Gigi was known to be a terrible cook. Julio's daughter said, "Since my stepmother started cooking for us, I spent a week suffering from stomach pain, dizziness, vomiting, and I also fainted. She usually cooked noodles and made us some tea. My dad got pneumonia soon after." The straw that broke the camel's back was when Julio's daughter discovered that her dad's life savings of 30,000 pesos was gone. In the money box were pieces of newspaper, folded like banknotes. Remember, Julio was blind, so clearly, Gigi replaced the cash with the newspaper pieces to deceive him. Julio asked her to leave and made it clear she was not welcome in his home ever again. From Julio's home, the once unsinkable Gigi Marano went into a nursing home, where she eventually passed away, all alone, on the 26th of April, 2014, at the age of 83. She is buried in Buenos Aires' Chacarita Cemetery, the same cemetery where Nilda, Lelia, and Memo were buried, a grim afterlife reunion of sorts. Her name does not appear on her headstone. Her family did not want her to be remembered as the poisoner of Montserrat. Instead, it memorializes Mercedes Borja. Gigi's son, Martin Marano, wrote a book called My Mother, Gigi Marano. He describes a loveless childhood with a self-obsessed mother. He recalled a chilling incident when he was 10 years old. She had bought pastries at a local bakery and offered him some. She sliced it in half and watched as he aimed to take his first bite. Just before the cake reached his lips, his mother grabbed it and threw it into the household incinerator. In hindsight, Martine believed she tried to poison him, but could not go through with it. In the book, Martine also claims that his mother had confessed to him. She allegedly said that she had laced the tea bags with poison, not the pastries. It was her best-kept secret. The book was published when Zsuzsa was still alive. She publicly said how hurt she was when she read it. In an interview with an Argentinian newspaper, she said that Martine had come to visit her from New York, where he lived, and that they had buried the hatchet. Martine claimed that this had never happened. He was estranged from her and only heard about her death 3 days after the fact, on TV. At the time of her arrest, in 1979, the media speculated that she had killed before and that there was an estimated 10 victims. To this day, Zsuzsa's case remains one of the most iconic cases in Argentinian criminal history. She reveled in her infamy and claimed that there was no evidence that she had killed her friends, insisting that they all died of natural causes. If that were the case, it was the coincidence of the century. She owed three friends money, and all three of them perished soon after having tea with Zsuzsa. Most people feel that she denied her guilt while holding the proverbial smoking gun. It could only have been Zsuzsa, the infamous poisoner of Montserrat. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe on Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now. And while you're waiting for our next episode, why not listen to one of our podcasting friends?
Hey friends, I'm Michael, host of the Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast. I would be delighted if you joined me every Thursday for a walk through the untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders of London's West End. Featuring hundreds of fascinating true crime tales you won't hear anywhere else. If you're looking for something different, the award-winning and highly acclaimed Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast is researched using the original police files. It's presented as a dramatization. Each episode is crafted as a labor of love, and it focuses on the victims' lives in an honest, detailed, and sympathetic way. Season 5 has just begun, so why not treat yourself to more than 150 episodes? If that sounds like your cup of tea, search for the Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast. Thank you.
This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.